those few minutes that we watched that film, that's devastating. I mean, you probably deal with this every day. My mother lived her last 12 years Alzheimer's, and I recognize so much of that. So let me start by asking your thoughts on the film. Start over here.
It's very accurate. Very realistic, and I my heart goes out to everyone who lives with these situations every day. My other thought in looking at the film is, especially looking at how the doctor handled things, would have done it way very, very differently.
You would have. How would you have done it?
I feel like doctors over-medicalize this disease and really take the humanity out of it. I think she was so focused on a certain aspect of getting information about the disease, but the information she was asking was very uncomfortable for the care partner to talk about in front of the person with dementia, and I would never have put either person in that position.
Well, I have to say that, you know, these are not actors. These are real people. But the woman walking in Midtown Manhattan scared me to death, just, you know, watching it as she's walking out in front of traffic. And unfortunately, as you said, it's all too accurate. So, Joel, your thoughts on what you saw?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very, it helps us see the individual, right? Like those three different stories. Every Alzheimer's disease is always just different stories, right? It's just different people. It's every individual in that heartbreaking story. I will say that it was, and obviously that's just a small clip, higher functioning folks in this
video. Right, you know, there are same thing. This although journey. There are probably different stages. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. I mean, they're all fairly, it depends on what stage system you use. And that's a whole complicated thing too,
right,
of how
right,
we look at this disease
right.
process. But they're all still pretty mobile, still talking, still interacting. And this journey, you know, goes to bedbound, like non-responsive, and lots of steps in between. So maybe you see more of that. But it is certainly a really challenging stage when people are still very mobile and moving around and still, I think, you see not wanting to talk about those symptoms, right? And sort of protecting themselves. I think that's what happened in that doctor's office, right? Like she didn't want to hear about her having anger issues or getting lost. And that's why she left. And so it's a good one stage of that. And there's lots of other things that go along with that as well.
Mm-hmm. Megan, your thoughts?
Sure. I really agree with my colleagues here that it really highlighted the humanity and the person. You know, we all probably are here for a reason, for a person or someone that we care about. It also really made me think about in the previous documentary, there was a quote. So I'm from the Department of Aging, from the state. But the quote in the previous documentary said that the people are what matter to government. And I think that this reminds me of that, and us at the Department of Aging, that we are looking and working with people at every level of things that we do.
You know, something else that jumped out at me is that many people who aren't familiar with dementia and familiar with Alzheimer's disease think it's just being forgetful. That's the one symptom that everyone exhibits. And, Joel, as you said, it's a different journey for everyone. I mean, there was a lot of anger in the one woman. Both of them that had been diagnosed were in denial, which leads me to believe they still were in the fairly early stages of Alzheimer. But everyone is different.
Yeah.
And, I mean, how do you deal with that when you're working with someone or... providing care to someone with Alzheimer's.
So there was this doctor named Dr. Connor back in the 70s who did a lot of research in amyloid and really helped us understand that. And he was the one, I think, the first one to coin the term, when you've worked with one patient with Alzheimer's disease, you've worked with one patient with Alzheimer's disease, right? And so this idea that everybody is just so very different because all of our brains are wired so very differently because of those unique experiences in our lives, right? And so you're talking about memory loss. And people do see that when you talk to people about what is Alzheimer's disease, and they'll say, well, people get, they forget things or they get confused. And memory loss and confusion are two very common symptoms, right? And that's not to downplay those things. Those are devastating symptoms. Memories are who we are, right? We are the product of the experiences that we've had, of the people that we've known, right? And so when you lose those, are you losing who you are as a human being, right? I mean, that's a very existential question, but memory loss is devastating. And so is confusion, this idea that you don't know what's going to happen next. And so when you hear somebody with Alzheimer's say, what do I do now? Where are we supposed to go? What am I supposed to do? When are we having lunch? These questions they ask over and over again that you're like, oh my goodness, why do they keep repeating themselves? Imagine if we had no idea what was the next step. Right, we live our lives in this planned order. Our brains always try to put order to our lives, right? And it's not always correct. You might be having plans after this, but you have a flat tire, and so those plans get blown up, right? But your brain is always trying to put order to things. But imagine if you couldn't anymore. Imagine if you had no idea what the next thing was and how much anxiety that would produce and how fearful that would make people. So yeah, those are very common. But there's so many other symptoms too of perception changes, of motor skill losses, of personality changes, of emotional dysregulation, all these things. Everything that's in your brain, which is everything, as your brain is destroyed, everything is affected by this disease.
We took some questions from the audience, and this is probably a good time to ask this, and I'll direct it to you, Dr. Wright. How do you differentiate between the onset of dementia and just being a little forgetful? I'm sure we all, when we've reached a certain age and we forget something, someone's name or something like that. I've done it myself many times. Uh-oh, I hope this isn't the onset of dementia.
Yeah, on the Alzheimer's Association website, there is this really nice table which talks about normal cognitive aging, and it kind of lists a bunch of characteristics. And then it matches on the other side of this table when those things are pathological. I think to put it really simply, when memory loss or cognition is affecting your efficiency in everyday life is, you know, where memory loss starts to create inefficiencies, takes longer to do things. You know, that's when the not being able to find something or not being able to remember something becomes a problem. And it goes, as the disease progresses from merely cognition loss interfering with or causing inefficiencies to actually causing disabilities where people start to really need help.
Good example is when the daughter was talking to her mother about toothbrush and toothpaste, and the mother went for the soap. I mean, that's a great example of things that you have done every day of your life that you no longer recognize that, okay, I have to use the toothpaste on the toothbrush rather than the soap. Megan, I want to ask this question from our audience as well, and maybe jumping around a little bit on the three of you. Is there any financial assistance for memory care patients in private nursing homes from Medicare, which is a federal program, or other federal or state agencies?
So I think when you go to look at resources that the state provides, it is super complicated. So I work at the
government.
I mean, it's
complicated?
Shocking. The state government is confusing. But I think, so at the Department of Aging, something that we're really working for, and there's back at our table in the back, and I think in the front there is, and I brought a visual aid, our info on our care kit for, it's brand new, just released in the last month there at the Department of Aging. And it is a resource for caregivers. So we talked about in the last panel about what do caregivers do? How can people find resources? And this is a great place to start. It's not going to answer all your questions because, as we mentioned, it's very confusing in state government. But it's a really great resource and a place to start of what's available, who to reach out to, who to ask. And of course, our community partners, the Alzheimer's Association was mentioned, Dementia Friends, they're a wonderful organization too, that they can help you navigate this incredibly confusing situation that's also highly personal. Like we talked about, everyone's situation is different. So what one person might need in a congregate care setting, or what someone else might need in their home, what physician is right for them, how a doctor handles things, it's all really different. And I think as a caregiver, which it seems like that's a really popular topic, you know, with everyone here tonight and in the film, it really highlighted the caregivers of those, you know, family members. So it's a great place to start. And of course, I think advocating for yourself, calling, asking questions of everyone, finding folks who are here tonight that spoke on the previous panel of who can been through this before, who can help you navigate a situation that might be similar.
You quoted the first film, and it's so true, that the people are really what matters. But when you're talking about something as large as state government, and especially the federal government now, where we don't know what is going to be cut, what's going to be available, what's not. Now, I'm not going to get into politics, but at the same time, people who are in our first panel, a caregiving situation, those who have a family member who are living with Alzheimer's, have to be really concerned, really worried about what kind of resources, what kind of financial help, what there is for those people, especially when we hear, you know, that I the last figure, I think I heard 21 million people may be suffering from Alzheimer's disease by the year 2030. So, you know, we're talking about a lot of people. That may be a question that's difficult for you to answer, but how do you real people in government realize we're talking about real people with real problems?
Well, I think caring for people with real problems is not political. And I think
that's not the
goal of our department and of the current administration is really trying to serve people as best we can, as fast as we can. And it is incredibly unstable at the federal government. And I think that provides uncertainty for us at the state too. But I know we're really just trying to keep our heads down, work as hard as we can on all of the programs that we administer at Department of Aging and with our sister agencies, Department of Health and Human Services, and really trying to serve people as best and as fast as we can with the resources that we have too.
Mm-hmm. I think something you said earlier is so true as someone who's gone through it is you have to advocate for yourself. Bug the crap out of someone if you have to.
Yes, I think the same about resources.
Is that
too,
your motto? Advocate, bug
yes.
the crap out of someone if you have to?
Yes, please not me, but someone else would be happy to answer your questions. But I think, you know, advocating for yourself, for causes that matter, you know, those phone calls and that outreach do make a difference.
Couple questions that are related, and Dr. Wright, I'm going to direct them to you, but everyone can jump in with this. My parent is 77 years old. We gave her a place to live, but she doesn't appreciate that. She always complains that we about how we treat her. She always wants to go back to living by herself. This is related somewhat. It says, how do you respond to a patient with Alzheimer's who insists he or she is right when he or she believes is wrong and might lead to injury or harming themselves or others? There's a second question here. Let me see if that's related. That's a little bit different. I think we saw a good example of that just in the short clip of the film. There is that stage of denial for a lot of people. A lot of people, when they're diagnosed or suffering from Alzheimer's, their personality changes. How do you deal with that?
So I coach families. I talk publicly about this. I teach residents. I teach anyone that I can that they're just not going to be able to see it from your point of view. Their brain is changing. They are who they are, but they're different now. And also you have to remember that communication absolutely changes because the language center and the memory center are tied really tightly together in the brain. And what I mean by language is understanding your words. I don't have the equipment anymore to be able to understand all the really smart things you're trying to tell me. And not only that, I don't have the memory to be able to hang on to it. So I'm not able to learn new information. So I think the person who has to change in those dynamics is us, the people that don't have the disease. And we need to change our dialogue. If how we want to engage is to try to convince them, you know what, you have this really bad disease, and I know because I'm watching you and I have all this information about just how bad it is. You know, you really did try to leave the house the other day. You really did say something very mean to me. The person with dementia is never going to be able to have the kind of insight that that's what's happening. And so we need to change and not present all the ugly little things about this disease and then impose the expectation on the person with disease that they're going to change what they say and how they act. So instead, we need to change how we respond in those moments. And how we respond is more along the lines of, and if anyone here has ever heard me speak before, there might be one or two people. I know Katie has heard me say this many times. I go by the rule of three, which is with people living with Alzheimer's, and this is very strong advice, don't ask. Because they don't have the equipment to understand your question. And if they don't understand what you're asking of them, what's the answer? It's no. Don't explain. Because your explanation is really a long-winded way of saying something that's disagreeing with what they're saying. And you're trying in an explanation to get them to see it from your point of view. And when you're explaining, you're assuming that they have equipment to understand all of your rationalizations. So those are pretty fruitless. The third thing is don't argue. So if they're insisting that they need to go home, this is not their home, I got to go home, then the response is not, this is your home, look around, this is where we live now. That's pretty scary to a person who is just not recognizing their place. So instead of doing any of those three things, we really need to kind of align and kind of see it from their point of view. We need to go with their flow. We need to find out where they are and get in their moment. And then once we're in their moment, then we can guide them to safety. Well, we gotta go. This doesn't look familiar. Well, let's go. I'm going with you.
I thought the part of the film with the father and the son did that very well when he asked about where his other son was. And, you know, he didn't tell him the truth, but just what you said, he wouldn't understand. He told him once that his brother was gone or son was gone. And you just go with that flow. A lot of times it doesn't make a lot of sense to those not suffering from dementia, but you kind of do with that. You know, Joe, one of the most heartbreaking moments just in that film, and for anyone who has a loved one with Alzheimer's, is when they don't know your name anymore or they don't recognize you anymore. And again, another example. And if, you know, one of the things that really struck me about that was how normal her mother spoke. And mm-hmm. My daughter wasn't, she had to work. She wasn't at the beach with us. But it was said in like a normal tone. Yeah. There sounded like there was no, she was very articulate about it. She didn't sound confused. It was just that my daughter was not with us. She had to work that day. That is just something that is so devastating to people.
Yeah, I think that's one of the big markers along this journey, right? When your loved one doesn't recognize you as a person. And it's so devastating for families. And the thing I think that we have to keep in mind about this is that we constantly, as Dr. Wright was saying, we're the ones that always have to adapt, right? And it's not that we want to. It's not that we want to accept the situation. This disease is really hard. But if we want to stay connected as much as we can and provide as good care as we want to our loved one, we have to adapt, right? And we have to understand what's going on. And so recognizing when your loved one doesn't recognize you, right? Or at least they don't know your name. But we have to say, like, they probably still do know you as a loved one. My own grandmother had dementia, and she had 10 grandkids. And so at some point, if you were a boy, she just called you Kevin, because that was the oldest grandson, right? And if you were a girl, she called you Maureen, because I was her oldest granddaughter. And you could be sad about that she didn't know. Me, Joel, personally, is her grandchild, but she still understood the family relationship, right? She was still happy to see me. She was still recognized me as one of her own. So that was us adapting to that situation. Not situations that you want to adapt to, but this is the reality of it. So how do we make those connections? And to add on to what Dr. Wright was saying too, when families are saying things, not necessarily about the forgetting the family name, though it's important, as she did a really good job there with her mom and not overreacting to that situation. Then she had her outlet on social media, which is really good. Not to get super upset in that situation, but when we're communicating with folks with dementia and they're saying things that you know are wrong, and not correcting them, as Dr. Wright said, but pay attention to the emotion that's being expressed. Sometimes the words are less important than the feelings that they're having. And then we use, at Country Meadows, we use a tool called the validation method, which is this way that you join into somebody's world and how you communicate and connect with them. But you react to those emotions and not necessarily the words that they're saying. So, like, if somebody is really frustrated, they're saying, well, we got to get the sheep back in the barn before we do anything else. They're just really agitated, even though you're not dealing with sheep, you're not on a farm, right? You don't have to say, there's no sheep here. Like, that's ridiculous. You don't live on a farm anymore. You say, like, Mrs. Smith, you're really agitated today, aren't you? That's really upsetting. And she might be like, yeah, I'm agitated. And then you connect on that level. So we have to let go of logic. Something that we actually do with Penn State, which is really great. We have the med students over, oftentimes fourth-year med students over, to do the storytelling with our residents with dementia. And we do this program called Time Slips, which is a non-linear, non-logical storytelling thing, which is hard for young doctors. Like, tell them, don't be logical, don't be linear, we're just going to go with it, right? It is really helpful, because when most doctors see somebody with dementia, it's 5 minutes in a little office and they don't have anything to do for this person. It's very uncomfortable. So how do we just move them along? And so when we do the storytelling with them, they get to join their world and journey a little bit and get it out of logic, right? And just have fun with this and get to see these folks as human beings and not just this patient that they don't have any cures for. So I think that education is really important.
You know, you just used the word fun. This is not fun, okay? But there are times where you have to laugh.
Mm-hmm.
My mom took her for ice cream one day, and she saw a man with a shaved head, and she said, I'd like to autograph his head. And I didn't know quite what to say to that. I said, Mom, mm-hmm. I don't think we could do that. Why not? I think it'd be funny. Well, I don't think he'd like it. So, you know, might turn my head and just laughed a little bit, but there are times like that where they'll come up with something, and they'll even laugh every once in a while, but then they do get to a point where laughter is not a big thing. You know, Megan, the numbers just are really concerning, frightening. I don't know what other adjective to use when we're talking about the number of people as they're aging, the number of people that will develop dementia and Alzheimer's. By the way, let me just come back to you in a minute. What's the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's?
That's one of the most common questions.
I hate to ask common questions, but go ahead.
So Alzheimer's is one type or family of dementias. There are several different families or types of dementias. Alzheimer's is just one. The pathology is a little different.
Is Alzheimer's the most serious?
I actually think it might be the easiest one.
They're all serious.
They all have challenges, but some of them have a different set of challenges. Like the woman who ran out in traffic in New York City, like the type of dementia that she has is not Alzheimer's. And that type is very, very challenging for families. And
what did she have?
She had probably a frontotemporal degeneration with primary progressive aphasia. So that's another family of dementias, is frontotemporal degeneration.
Okay. So, Megan, let me get back to you now. the numbers and how frightening they are. What does the Department of Aging see as the biggest challenges that we as a country, we as a state, are facing with the number of people who are already diagnosed and more coming?
Yeah, that's a huge concern for us at the Department of Aging, and obviously would give a big plug for supporting us and our agency and advocating for us just like before. But I think, we're really making sure that as our department sees what's coming, that we are also trying to do our best to educate others about what we're going to see with older adults in the Commonwealth. One of my friends here at WITF mentioned our Aging Our Way. It's our 10-year multi-sector plan that the Department of Aging has put together that really outlines steps to improve aging across the Commonwealth for the next 10 years. So you can visit that at aging.pa.gov. I think that's a plan that we have. And then in terms of Alzheimer's and dementia, we have a state plan that is from 2014, so that is super old. And one of my goals with our brand new office, so our Office of Alzheimer's and Dementia here at the Commonwealth is new. It's only existed since October. It's the first time ever at the Commonwealth that exists. And we are looking to update that plan, include experts like these folks here. I would like to invite myself to Country Meadows to learn about the storytelling program. And I think those are the kind of things we want to include in that plan that really set us up for the next 5 years and how we can better educate the public, how we can better educate physicians, all about dementia as a whole.
Educate them about what? I mean, awareness, one of the reasons that this film was made and that it's going to be shown nationally is to make people aware, to educate people. What do they have to be taught? What do they have to be aware of?
I think it depends on the person and the stakeholder group. Number one, you asked the question, what's the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's? That's a great start. I think, our medical community are seeing, folks are seeking healthcare in many different ways. So not everyone gets the pleasure of seeing Dr. Wright. Some folks are maybe only going to their dentist every couple years, and we want to make sure that those healthcare providers are knowing signs and symptoms, early detection, diagnosis, things like that. What are you noticing in your parent or your loved one? What's going on? How can I seek help? And then also providing people with resources, because it's one thing to know there's a problem, but then we've talked a lot today about what do you do.
Right.
So how can we recommend folks call the 1-800 number that the Alzheimer's Association has, reach out to Penn State? What other resources like Country Meadows exist in your community that you can seek help? And that's something that we're hopefully going to implement in our upcoming state plan.
This is one of our audience questions. Joel, I'll direct this one to you, but again, anyone can jump in.
Okay.
Can you speak about the right time to encourage a dementia patient to move into a care setting and good time to introduce the subject and convincing them with information?
Yeah, that's a tough one. Because the right time is about 20 years ago. We as a society don't necessarily age all that well. I don't know if you're recognizing this fact, but my wife and I were recently in a Rite Aid, and we were just picking up a prescription, but I saw a couple, older adults, they were sharing a walker, and like one was on each side of it, and they were kind of shopping down, and that was when I was like, we don't do a good job aging as a society. It's not those two people's fault. It's all of our faults. Like, where are our systems and our resources for older adults so they could go shopping successfully, right? But one of those resources is about where can you live successfully. We all, as we talked about with the caregivers, everybody wants to be at home, or at least they want the idea of being at home, right? But oftentimes for senior, that idea of home is total isolation, malnourishment, right? Not getting their meds properly, not getting health care, not seeing other human beings. That's not really living. And so the time to have these discussions is before somebody has dementia, so that we're not making promises to our children of never put me in a home, right? And the other challenge with that is that when people say that, what they have in their heads are 1960s nursing homes. Right? That is the stereotype that is built into us, this 1960s nursing home that you're going to walk into and it's going to smell like baked in institutional urine, right? And people are going to be walking around in pajamas like zombies and or in wheelchairs around a nursing center. Nobody's doing anything, right? That is not where the long-term care world is today. There's great places out there. And so if you haven't had that discussion and now you have that resistance, which is very common, what we need to do as caregivers and loved ones is educate ourselves of what the resources are out there. Take tours of places, go see things. Educate yourself of the difference between independent living and personal care and assisted living and skilled facilities, and have a plan, because if they're super resistant, you might have to wait for the time of something to happen, right? So a fall happens, they end up in the hospital, they have pneumonia, end up in the hospital, and then you have an opportunity to make a move, but you had better be educated before that, because the social worker at the hospital is like, mom's getting discharged at 4 o'clock and you got to come get her. And so you need to have a plan ahead of time so that you've got options.
Scott, I'd like to weigh in on that question. Okay. So one of the things that I do in memory clinic is my task, the kind of appointment that I have, is to come up with a dementia care plan. And it's a dementia care plan. It is something that is planning for now and for very predictable things that are going to come up in the future. When you're talking about convincing the person with dementia that they need to do, that it's time for them, that's not the right necessary approach. I say that the family needs to come up with a plan for what's going to happen to you if something happens to me and I can't take care of you anymore. We all need to weigh in together on where that place would be. The right time to go into a setting, a community, I don't like calling them facilities, it makes them sound like prisons.
I know. I always search for the word to use, because no one wants to say nursing home.
Community. It's a community. It's a community for memory support. So the right time is when the person's needs exceed what the care partners can provide. And the decision to go into community is not only up to the person with dementia, it's up to everybody that's in their sphere. It's a team decision. And everything we do, sometimes it just has to work for the care partners as much as it works for the person with dementia. And so we're not going to get to perfect, but we need to get to the best balance, whatever the solution is, that is the best for everybody.
You know, something that we were talking earlier about resources, and you know, the first segment we talked about financial impact on caregivers. I don't know what the percentage is, but I know it's high, of the number of people who are in a care wing, a memory care wing, that are suffering or diagnosed with Alzheimer's, is that many of them have to use Medicaid.
No one can afford long-term care, not one of us.
And right now, we know what's going on in Washington. Again, that is one of the scariest things about this, is that there are so many people who are suffering from dementia, from Alzheimer's. That's how they're going to pay for their care.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if it's not there?
The landscape of long-term care is about to change dramatically, and it's going to be nursing homes, if they don't have Medicaid payments, which don't really pay to keep the lights on anyway, if they don't have that, then they're going to close down, and you're going to see an absolute escalation of care, of long-term care, informal care partnering happening at home. That's where it's going to go.
I hate to leave it on that note, but that's the reality. I wish we had more time, actually. I want to thank the three of you for being with us today, Dr. Roland Wright, Joel Croft, and Megan Abbott. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.